Hi, I'm Malcolm Nichols.
And I'm Richard Ayling.
And this is Man Reimagined, a podcast where we, as men, attempt to reimagine ourselves in the 21st century.
How can we respond to the big questions that we're facing, both within ourselves and within society, and make sense of this ever-changing world?
We don't have all the answers, but we do want to create a conversation. So join us moving forward as a man reimagined.
Hey everyone, welcome to another edition of the Man Reimagined podcast. My name is Richard Ayling and I'll be your host this week. Today I am super excited to bring to you a conversation I recently had with Mark Walsh. If you're not already familiar with Mark and his work, he is someone that has done a lot to promote awareness of this topic, embodiment and trauma. A couple of years ago during COVID, he organized the Embodiment Conference and he brought together a lot of the kind of teachers in this field. And I believe it still has the world record for the largest amount of participants to an online event. And it was something like 500,000. So he's done a lot to promote awareness of this kind of work. And we dive straight into this topic because he's able to give, I think, a really clear, relatable understanding of what this actually is in everyday life and why it's important, especially to men as fathers, as co-workers and partners. I also invited Mark on to talk about way more than that because he's someone that is a straight talker. He's someone that is, he doesn't mince his words. He doesn't hold back what he thinks. And he doesn't do that specifically to provoke. He's just someone that is, like a few other people like that come to mind, is able to just go past that point of like caring so much and needing to present himself in a certain way, which to me makes him extremely authentic. And I always laugh and chuckle when I hear such brazen honesty and authenticity. And you'll hear me do that several times during this podcast. He, as he's very well aware, can also rub people up the wrong way. And perhaps a couple of the things that he says during this podcast might do that, although I find them personally very refreshing and interesting points of view on a range of topics, which I'll get to in a moment. But first, I'm going to dive into his very tongue-in-cheek bio, which gives you a good sense of who he is, but also what he's accomplished over quite an interesting career. Mark Walsh, or Mr. Embodiment, is the author of Embodiment, Working with the Body in Training and Coaching, and Embodied Meditation. He hosts the Embodiment podcast with over 1 million downloads and led the Embodiment conference with over 1,000 teachers and 500,000 delegates. He founded the Embodiment Facilitator course UK and Russia and has trained over 2,000 embodiment coaches in over 40 other countries, some of which will even let him back in. He gained an honours in psychology despite being an alcoholic at the time, and has taught widely in the corporate world where he pretended to be a grown-up for years, training blue-chip companies like Unilever, Shell, AXA and L'Oreal, whom he overcharged as they made him wear a suit. He has also taught many yogis, NGOs, police officers and several militaries. He has worked in war zones and showed off to over 50,000 children. He has headlined International Coach Federation events, taught at Moscow State University, lived with the circus in Ethiopia, taught celebrities, and kissed the princess. Mark is an Aikido black belt and also has 25 years of experience of other martial arts with yoga, bodywork, improv comedy, conscious dance, and meditation. Embodiment is his obsession, life's work, and frankly, at this point, he couldn't get a job doing anything else. He dances like your dad at a wedding, overshares about his gorgeous Ukrainian wife, and offends pirates with his swearing and woke German feminists with his testicles. So that should give you a flavor and a sense of the man. In the podcast itself, we cover what embodiment is, and he gives such a relatable, grounded understanding of this word. He talks about how embodied men lead better lives as fathers at work and in relationships. We also talk about how men and women relate differently to embodiment, his experience teaching at Google and at the police force, his thoughts on the oppressive patriarchy narrative, which I found refreshing and helpful, masculinity today and where men find themselves, male and female relationships. And then we move into talking about his recent work in Ukraine, teaching embodiment and trauma, what trauma is and how it's being taught today. And then we finally wrap up by looking at why there are less men in embodiment spaces than before, interestingly, and also looking at kind of male-friendly and female-friendly spaces too. So, without further ado, I give you Mark Walsh.
Hi, Mark. Welcome to the podcast. Thank you for taking some time out of your already busy day to come and talk to me. How are you doing?
I'm good. It's a nice way to end the day, actually. So nice to see you.
So let's just dive in and give our audience, who some of them might be aware of your work already, and I've obviously introduced you at the beginning of the podcast, but I'd love you to explain from your own point of view, your own in your own words, like how you'd like to be described of or thought of professionally, because you offer a lot at the moment, and I'm interested.
Yeah, I mean, I'm an embodiment teacher, and previously in interviews people would say, oh, you're the embodiment guy, you're Mr. Embodiment, I'd sometimes get, you know, and that sort of stuck as a bit of a nickname, because, you know, after you've done the embodiment conference, the embodiment podcast, the book, you know, after a while, I kind of picked a word and ran with it that was central to my interests, in some ways redefined it a little bit, I think, over the years. And that's my passion, that's my topic, and everything, the work I do around leadership or trauma or stress management or training coaches or yoga teachers, it's all embodiment.
That is, it's a big word, and we've sort of touched upon it in our podcast, because embodiment and men are two words that you wouldn't necessarily imagine being magnetized together, right? So, and yet here you are, kind of a down-to-earth bloke, may I say, from Brighton, that's just made like a really big thing out of it. It's obviously meaningful to you. And I'm wondering if you, for our audience, anyone listening, wouldn't mind kind of defining what embodiment means to you, because you mentioned it in the context of yoga and teaching and so much
else. So poetic definition, coming home to the body, poetic definition. Slightly less poetic. I mean, I've got a whole chapter in a book defining it. I think usually it's the first question I get asked. And sometimes I say it's a type of intelligence, like bodily intelligence. And there's different aspects of that, which I've sort of broken down into eight different, you know, subsets within that. So you get quite specific. We could say it's the subjective study of the body, more sort of philosophically. And you can also think of it as a coverall term for the movement arts that also involve body awareness. So there's actually a few different definitions that relate. And you also see different definitions from sociology or robotics, or, you know, has different definitions, different places. So I've used it in a particular way. Why? Sort of traditionally, it was considered almost a feminine domain. You know, the body was feminine, masculine was the mind. And, you know, this has its roots on certain Greek traditions, Christian traditions. I wouldn't say it was global, but it has a certain root there. And I think that led to certain problems generally, both for women and for men. And I feel like men are really, really discovering their bodies and realizing that this is, it's vital. Now, if you're a woman and you start bleeding from the crotch as a teenager, this may be kind of more of a stark awakening to your sort of bodiliness. And I think for guys, though, you know, we have our own awakenings to the body, whether that be sexually or through sports, you know, for a lot of people. And we start to realize something important is there. You know, even sports people will report transcendent, meaningful experiences. Bodily things always tend to be the most popular things, no matter how cognitive, cerebral, you know, we live in a cerebral age of laptops and iPhones and the rest of it, but sex and cake is still pretty popular, you know, like bodily things are still pretty popular. So, you know, I was at the gym today, I love it. I just love the feeling of it. And that feeling world, I think, guys, if we look at the sort of mental health state of the modern man, you know, it's not, there's not really such thing as mental health, is body mind health, right? Feeling a cut off from yourself is certainly part of anxiety disorders, for example, depression, whatever it is, you know, the lethargy in the body of depression. So I think men are sort of waking up that, hey, all those women in yoga classes might be onto something here. they might not be stupid. And maybe that was more accessible to women in a way, the whole sort of mindful movement approach, conscious dance tends to be more women, yoga tends to be more women. martial arts often were men, which was my route in. So I never regarded embodiment as a sort of feminine practice, or I've had female, like, you know, teachers and stuff. But, you know, I was around a lot of guys through martial arts. So that was really good for me. So that was the sort of first men's group I was ever in, was an unofficial one called Aikido Club, you know, an all martial arts club. It was just round guys. There was hierarchy and elders and knowledge that could be passed on, like, you know, analogous to a more tribal culture. And that was extremely helpful for me as someone who, you know, had a drunken dad he didn't get on very well with, and had all sorts of problems with discipline, authority, the sort of masculine generally, had aggressive impulses, sexual impulses. It's like, what am I going to do with this? And certainly for me, first with martial arts and then in the wider world of meditation, conscious dance, body therapy, I'm sort of mapping the field here. You know, the first place I entered into that was a very male space.
I find that interesting because you've already mapped out so much there, right? And then if we can if we can sort of get generic for a moment and talk about how I think a lot of people still perceive the world of embodiment, you do have this kind of this side of martial arts and sport which men tend to be attracted to in general, right? Let's generalize. I think that's fair. Most, and then women tend to go into more the kind of the ethereal realms of, like, say, mindful movement, yoga, kind of dance and that kind of thing. Yet you've mentioned that you do all of that now. Like, I am a yoga teacher myself, you know, I like Qigong and I'm learning martial arts, and yet there's still a deep resistance to some of the inverted commas feminine kind of movement practices, which is ludicrous. And yet I still have this kind of block and this discomfort in doing that. So what do you say to men out there that might also have that same kind of resistance to more of those, like, explorative practices of dance, for example?
So don't be a pussy. What are you scared of? No, I mean, I'd say try it. I'd say give it a go. And once you'd like, imagine I'm from a sort of fairly working class, actually from East Anglia, not Brighton originally. And for me, doing dance was bizarre. You know, martial arts was sort of, fighting, that's allowed, you know. But then I realized I started to like movement just within the martial arts. It's like, I really love moving. And my martial arts was very creative. And people kept saying, you should go dance, you'll love it. I was like, no way, mate, not me, mate. So I do totally get that. We're enculturated in a certain way. And then I tried it. I was like, this is really fun. I just enjoyed it a lot. And it made me feel good. And, you know, the other thing I'd say is most blokes care about their work and they care about their families. That's it, really, for most blokes. That's what they care about. And you will get better at your work if you do this stuff. Like, if I have employees who meditate and do mindfulness movement practices, they will consistently be more centered, have more energy, take less sick days, have more creative ideas. I mean, I just can name the ways in which an employee with those skills is just better than one who isn't.
Why do you think that is, if I can ask?
Well, their skill sets are generalizable. That's what embodiment is. So, you know, can you be a leader without self-awareness? No. Can you learn self-awareness from a book? No. Can you learn it in a dojo? Yeah. What about self-regulation? You know, I've got all sorts of financial worries, right? And I'm, you know, stressed out. And I'm like, whoa, I've got a lot going on. And it's like a lot of people right now. But the difference is I've got the practices that I can regulate myself. And I just taught for 3 hours before this interview, blinding classes and supervision and one-to-ones. Just really well done because I was able to self-regulate. Or, you know, who's a better manager, the one who can listen or the one who can't? That's an embodied skill, you know, intuition, listening. And influence, you know, you think you can be a leader without, influence. And this counts for everything from having authority to flirting is embodied. You know, it's like, hello, I'm Neil, I'm your manager, I'm not in my body and I'm here to lead you. It's like, who the fuck wants that? So, yeah, I just mapped embodied intelligence very broadly. There's a bit more to it, but how would that not make you more effective? Whatever, even if your job's computer programmer, right? Like, I say this, people say, oh, I'm a creative, I don't need to be in my body. I'll say, you know, the media workers have to come up with good ideas all the time. I'm like, well, where do you have your best ideas? I say, I can predict it. I can predict what you will say. And then listeners can, you know, just think, where do you have your best ideas? 90% of listeners will be saying in the shower, going for a walk in the woods, or taking a shit. And they're all times when you're in your body and relaxed. right? So it's like, now you only have a shit once a day, but you know, I can do embodiment whenever I want. So, you know, again, I'm using sort of funny examples, but like, if you have to have ideas, you better be in your body. You know, if you have to maintain resilience, you better be in your body. Like the work I'm doing in Ukraine, I better have some in-body tools, you know, to do anything that's challenging. So I'd say to guys, I'd say, one, just try it. You probably like it. Most of us do, even if there's that resistance, which I do get. And secondly, it's like, do you want to be better at what you do? And, you know, in terms of like families, if you're in your body, you're great with kids. Like I'm like a magnet to kids. I work with 50,000 kids in my life, and being in the body, they just want to play. You know, like, what dad doesn't want that? You know, it's so I love being an uncle. Romance, which is sexier? A man who's in his body, grounded, strong, there, present, or one that's just in their head? I mean, I can't imagine a woman in the world saying the former. I mean, she might say, I want like a clever man, but just clever? Not so much. So, don't do it unless you want to be, you know, better at what you do, better dad, sexier, funnier, all those things. And it doesn't make you superhuman, but it helps. It really helps. And sometimes it's just what gets me through the day. And I think if I didn't have this, how would I get through the day? Mm. Really, like with the chaos in the world right now, I kind of feel like this is survival level stuff, not even excellence level.
I love that. Let's zoom out a little bit, because there's so many ways into the body and to experience embodiment. Obviously, I threw the extreme example that I have resistance to of dancing, but there are so many ways for men or anyone to come into the body. And of course, you gave references like being out in the forest and like, what are some of the simple ways with which you work with people that don't invite them to immediately start dancing around the room? You know, like what are some of the
simple ways? Yeah, I can't do that. My corporate client, that's why we Googled the other day, it wouldn't have gone down well. Yeah, I've worked in the corporate world and with militaries and police and, you know, all sorts of people. And obviously, with kids, it might be games. With businessmen, it might not be, right? It's going to be different things. Something as simple as a trainer of getting people to stand up and walk around instead of sitting in chairs. Or right at the other end of the spectrum, something as profound as really deep trauma work so people can start feeling and not be so numb or not be so hyper-aroused, not be so fired up. And so really on that spectrum, it can be from the ridiculous, like I'm coaching someone, let's stand up, let's go to the park. Right, we'll do the rest of the coaching session walking around the park, and they're immediately just more in their body. The other thing, if you're in your own body, that invites it in other people. It's infectious in a way, you know. And you know that if you've been at a yoga festival, everyone's around each other and there's a nice sort of virtuous spiral. Everyone's more in their body, they're feeling, they're more calm, they start getting better co-regulated, and you know, before you know it, everyone's just the best they've ever been. Everyone's shiny and having great ideas and really happy. You know, like that's who you hang out with is kind of a big one. Being around other embodied people, which is important if you're around, say, traumatized people who are maybe not so much in their bodies, to at least make space elsewhere. Centering, so basic state regulation tools. I'm like, you know, I remember walking into the Met, it's like some of the top policemen and women in the country, and just saying, look, give this a try. If it helps, listen to me. If it doesn't, you can walk out. I'll sign you in as here. And, you know, give me 5 minutes. People tried the centering, basic, simple breathing exercises. And they're like, oh, I feel less stressed. I'm like, yeah, do you want more of that? You know, it's the lowest hanging fruit is actually the people that have never done much, because you don't have to do a whole lot for them to suddenly get a big, like, whoa, there's a big difference, you know?
Wow. I mean, Google, police, military, I mean, these are kind of huge organizations. Like, what's the kind of ripple effect that you would say you're noticing or you're getting feedback about from the people that attend your course and then what they're able to then go out and do? I mean, leadership is obviously one thing, but is what else have you noticed or heard about?
Well, it depends on what we're teaching. Obviously, like stress management outcomes will be different in some respects from, say, a leadership course. Or, you know, I'm training a lot of coaches now, so a lot of what I hear is kind of through them and their clients. I spend most of my time training other coaches to do it. That feels like the best way to have a bigger impact with it. Sometimes someone will come in and they'll go to a leadership course and they'll be like, my wife likes what's happening to me. And, you know, and I don't even know the details, and they're winking at me kind of thing. You know, I'm like, okay, there's something's working out there. Other times, you know, it's really touching things. People saying, I used to lose my temper and hit my kids, you know, someone with PTSD, and now I don't. You know, that's pretty beautiful to hear that. You know, I used to shout at my kids, now I don't. Yeah, and sometimes it's just little knock-on effects. Oh, I seem to be getting on better with my boys, or people listen to me a bit more at work. I've got a bit more gravitas, a bit more oomph now. So it really depends on the client and what they're working on. Because, you know, with embodiment, it could almost be opposite things. You've got one guy who's too cocky and needs to be humble, and someone else is lacking confidence and needs to take up a bit more space, you know. And these are physical things, right? Like we talk about embodiment, we're not talking about the body. So going to the gym isn't necessarily an embodied practice. You can be fit and not be embodied, like a, well, we're dancers and they're very fit, but they're often not in their bodies, or performers. It's not about, you know, how tall you are, how strong you are. You know, taking up space is as much a matter of presence as it is of height. I actually just saw one of my students who's really confident the other day, and I said to her, it's like people often say to me, I said, oh, I remembered you as bigger, you know, because it's like I remember her as a big character, a big personality, as someone that is dominant and knows how to sort of lead a room. And she's actually less than 5 foot tall. But I, if you'd have asked me, I would have said she was my height. So that's something I've got quite a lot in myself. And yeah, that people get embodiment. They just don't have a language for it. You know, like everybody gets the British Airways captain who's more calm than the EasyJet captain from their voice. And that, you know, it's like, hello, welcome to British Airways. I'm terribly relaxed. Like people get how states transmit, and they get certain people have it and they don't. They talk about chemistry and dating. Like everyone gets these ideas. A dog gets it. A dog knows if you're the boss or he's the boss. You know, kids get it. Kids know real quick if it's time for bed, or if they can sort of squeeze another half hour out of you because you're faltering, you know, when you tell them it's bedtime.
What would you say to the dad that's already a, you know, a pretty good dad and has a good relationship with his kids, like that might not be embodied or might not know what this word means? Is getting a sense from what you're describing, but what would you say to him as in like some introductory practices or ideas? Because I'm loving what I'm hearing. And I'm just wondering, the dad that does get on with his kids, how to check in, maybe he is embodied. Like, it's a language thing, right?
Yeah, I mean, giving parenting advice is always a good way to get a slap, you know, I find. But I've seen a lot of dads really, like, take their kids to karate class and do it with them, for example. And I've seen that as being beneficial almost without exception. When they've done an activity, like starting up climbing or whatever it is they do, you know, singing in a choir, whatever. So doing something physical with their kids that can be done with them. The other thing is like learn to play again. You know, like I feel sad. Like I know guys who can't get on the floor physically and emotionally. They sit in their armchair and, you know, I go to the houses, I'm straight on the floor and, you know, doing like airplanes and, you know, crap acro yoga kind of impersonations and things. And I think kids always appreciate that 100%. Kids are drawn to you if you're in your body. So it's like, even if people have decent relationships, like it's not normal to have really good human relationships at all. Friendships, romance, like it's normalized to have pretty disconnected relationships. And, you know, like I go dancing with my wife, we're more connected afterwards. You know, that's just how it is. Like there's a reason dancing has been part of courtship in every human culture, with the possible exception of our own, you know, throughout human history. There's a reason for it. You know, I've seen it in Ethiopia, I've seen it in Brazil. It looks different, but it's still movement, it's still embodiment.
Don't knock Morris dancing.
I love a bit of Morris dancing. We should be not ashamed of Western culture, I think, generally. And I think the attack on Western culture, as exemplified in Douglas Murray's book, The War on the West, which I highly recommend everyone read, is also attack on masculinity, and there's no doubt about it. And the demonizing of men in Hollywood, you know, the Star Wars franchise was a disgrace. Every advert you've almost ever seen, that demonizing of men is directly linked to the sort of weird self-hatred that's become popular in the West. And without and missing the gratitude for everything men built. And, you know, I saw a meme the other day, which is like, women burn everything to the ground, and they might have had a reason to be angry, and they might have had, you know, things I want to complain about and things I want to change, which is fair enough, you know, and things haven't been perfect for women for sure. You know, and you really want to burn everything men have built to the ground, and I mean literally and figuratively. And I'm looking out, I'm 13 floors up here, I'm looking out across Brighton, and that there's a beautiful town that's safe to live in with electricity, that has law and order. It's not perfect, you know, there's homelessness, there's drug issues in this town, but it's, you know, compared to Ukraine right now or Afghanistan, both which I've been, you know, it's pretty bloody nice. And maybe we should have some gratitude to the men, hands and brains who built that.
I mean, there's a lot to unpack just in the last few seconds of what you said. And I hear you. I imagine some people are going to be triggered by that. There's almost like a sense of, in me, there's a sense of, shit, can we talk about this? Like, it's almost like we mustn't, you know, because now we could get cancelled and this kind of like...
Oh, no, I'm going to get cancelled, speaking the truth. Well, here's the thing. I think we do need to acknowledge women's pain. I mean, it would be crazy not to know, like, the levels of sexual violence women suffer that were far more than I could have imagined before, you know, I was told stories and looked into it. You know, we do need to acknowledge that these things have really not been okay. And I think we also need to not have a, not just swap teams on that. We can't just go, you know, people talk about this, oh, this natural swing back. I'm like, that's just revenge you're talking about. That's dark. And, you know, there's some real serious issues for guys, whether it's prison stuff, whether it's education, you know, boys doing crap in schools in Britain. You know, most of the homeless guys are Britain. You know, I just come from Ukraine. It's most of the men that are doing the dying on the front lines. You know, and you can also say yes, but it's also women who are more at risk of sexual violence in that war. And you'd be right on both fronts. And I've got compassion for both of those things, you know. So it's I don't think we have to close our compassion off to men or to women. We can be sympathetic and understanding without framing it that one side has, quote unquote, suppressed the other one for all of human history. And it's a one sided deal. And, you know, that's all it is. Of course, it's not. Of course, it's not.
I'm with you, and I think that's become like a popular narrative now, and it's you know, on certain social media platforms that are dominated by women, it's, you know, it's just not a good idea to kind of pipe up in that sense. So it's like, how can we have more useful conversations and bring men and women together that don't actually think this, you know? Because as ever, what we see on social media and these kind of narratives in Hollywood, it's not actually what's going on, I think, in the day-to-day conversations that most men and women and people that don't identify as such are actually having. In terms of like masculinity, you said you have views on that. Like, why is it, do you think, that men are kind of so silent on this issue? And where do you see kind of men and masculinity today? Because this is a recent kind of trend, this you know, patriarchy oppressing everything. It's a conversation, but like, where have men been in the last kind of 50, 60 years? Why are we the way that we are now, which in my perception is kind of quiet and you know, not engaging much.
Yeah, well, there's different kinds of violence, right? And traditionally men have done physical violence, and I think we're not very good at social violence. I'm a bit reluctant to use the word violence sometimes, and social harm might be a better word, you know? Violence gets used for people being offended and upset these days, which I think is a misuse of the term. However, I think men see that we're bringing a knife to a gunfight if there's a conflict there. And I think most men just want to quietly get on with their lives. I'd also say most women really like men and have decent relationships with their husbands, brothers, sons, and dads. And I don't think the people who are pushing a pretty hardcore ideology right now, which has somehow become normal to say, talk about the patriarchy and this and that, these things that have become normal that would have been like radical, far left Marxist, you know, you would have got someone at Berkeley saying it, but it wouldn't have been on the TV. It wouldn't have been normal behavior, normal things your daughter came back from university talking about, unless she happened to be studying, you know, some ridiculous made up subject. And I think that the normalization of nonsense and really hardcore small political minority, like most women like men. Most women are all right. Most men are all right. Most of them get on. You know, like I look in my family, I go, who's oppressing who? Is my sister oppressing me, giving me emotionally support? Am I oppressing her, looking after her kids sometimes? I don't think we're oppressing each other. You know, I think we get on pretty well and we've got a pretty, not perfect relationship, but a pretty decent relationship. And I look at my niece and how, you know, parents do the best you can. I think that's pretty decent with her uncle and a dad and a granddad before he died, you know? So, this idea that there's a war between the genders, for me, it feels like a divide and conquer move. And it feels like letting a small, often traumatized, damaged minority who may have gone through very bad experiences control the narrative for a group, two groups of people who are getting on pretty bloody well most of the time. You know, considering how different we are, ooh, controversial again, considering how different we are, I think we do pretty bloody well. You know, me and my wife living in the same house with all our differences, we do all right, you know? So, I don't know. I feel it's pretty unhelpful to male and female relationships, how male and female relationships have been framed in the recent past and not really in keeping with the reality that I see.
And yet, why are we here now? Why are men also so quiet on this? You know, it's like you mentioned they're just kind of trying to get on with their lives. My sense is, and that's my sense, my perception with the clients I've been working with, the circles that I've been running, there's just like let's just keep the peace and keep our heads kind of, below the parapet.
Do you want to die on that hill? Do you want to die on that hill? Or do you want to go to work and get on with it? Do you know what I mean? Like often the battles are little by little and you go, I don't really care that much about this issue or if she's using that word or if this advert's a little bit anti-men. You know, that film of sort of all the male characters seem to be bad or incompetent, but you know what? Never mind. It's still a good movie. Like that's the normal thing, I think. I think the other one is men haven't had a narrative about this. Like, you know, in the same way as women did need rights-based feminism in the 60s, my mum fought for it. It's been a big thing in my family. They absolutely did need it. And, you know, in some parts of the world, you know, people ask me if I'm a feminist. I say, well, I'm in Russia. I am in Saudi Arabia, you know, like there's parts of the world where rights are really needed for women. But men haven't had the equivalent of that. The men's rights movement hasn't really given us that. Men don't know what being a man is. Teachers are nearly all women. A lot of men are absent from the home, or they're absent fully or, you know, emotionally, in the case of my own dad, for addiction, or at work, you know, all the time, not really raising the kids, not really around the kids. So men don't really know what it is that they would be fighting for. There's just some sort of quiet sense of, I'd quite like to not be wrong all the time. That'd be awesome. You know, and it's like, maybe I just keep my head down. So, we are living in a time that is hugely anti-male. And there isn't a narrative around that. And as I said, it ties in with the anti sort of Western civilization narrative of the sort of neo-Marxist kind of approach that's taken over the Western universities. First of all, just in strange places like Brighton, I've seen it for years, you know, and then eventually it's on GMTV. So it's everywhere. So, and I think we sort of thought, well, it's just over there in the university. It's just over there. And then it was in the HR departments and, you know, then it was in for everywhere in society, the schools and everywhere else. So I think men are starting to wake up to that. And you could say there is an evolution here, right? We could say that men and women are both progressing through a series of stages developmentally, as Ken Wilber would say. And while those developmental stages involve, you know, men opening up their feeling sense and their bodily sense, and I'm a big part of that, you know, and that can go too far. And often the environments I go to are quite kind of feminized environments. And, you know, the guys all look like they got long hair and you wouldn't leave them alone with your sister in a room for more than 2 seconds, you know. It's don't trust them as far as you can throw them. And then I'm around environments where, you know, like, for example, the Ukrainian women who run the project I started there, they are strong. You know, I come from a family of strong Irish women, so I like strong women. And they're kick-ass and they don't take any shit, but they love men. And they're quite all right being psychologists while men fight on the front lines. There are women on the front lines, but not nearly as many. And it's interesting, this gender narrative when you're in Ukraine, because it's like, well, women and children can leave Ukraine. Men cannot. And they didn't have a problem getting soldiers to sign up. In fact, the opposite. There's men are desperate to go fight to defend their families and their country. They're desperate for it. There's a joke that you have to sleep with in the Ukraine. You have to sleep with the woman who's in charge of the lists for the territorial army to get in, you know? And there's no shortage of really healthy, protective, wholesome masculinity that I see there. You know, and of course, on the Russian side, we see that it's super unhealthy, abusive side of, you know, men at their very worst in a war. And both of those are side by side.
Yeah, I mean, that's, I wanted to kind of bring in your experience of being in Ukraine recently and sharing what you've seen about, you know, actual reality on the ground. No doubt you're working with people, and I'm guessing there's PTSD and there's like live kind of very recent trauma that you're working with? Like, how have you been, well, that's a guess, but how have you been working with people there? Have been training people to help this inevitable onslaught of you know, upcoming trauma patients? Like, what's the reality on the ground there with men, women, just humans kind of dealing with this stuff?
Yeah, human beings. So a little background. So I first got involved in Ukraine with a coaching job, actually, before the start of the first part of the war, which was the Maidan protest. And then after that, there was various problems in the east, you know, which are where the main battlefields are now. And then the invasion of Crimea, and then eventually this big war that everyone knows about. But essentially, Ukraine's been at war for quite a while, and a lower level until recently. And I was doing some trauma education work for some coaches, because there wasn't that much trauma awareness at that point in Ukraine. And I was asked, after doing this coaching job, to do it. My wife is my interpreter, so I met her there. Wonderful love story. She ended up coming to England after some serious visa problems. We ended up living together in Brighton, which is, she's next door now, I can hear her. And when the sort of new escalation of the war started, I felt pretty upset, I felt pretty violated, I felt pretty angry. And I thought, am I going to go fight over there? Because it just seemed just clear right and wrong. You know, often wars are grey areas and nebulous, but unless you're a total conspiracy nut job, this is pretty black and white, you know? And there's an actual fascist dictatorship invading a sovereign democratic country. And actually fascist, not the sort of the Brighton left-wing version of that. And one of my friends pointed out to me that I wouldn't make a particularly good soldier, but I am a pretty good psychologist, and maybe I could go teach some trauma work. And so this was very early days in the war, first few weeks. I think it was like week three I arrived or something. And we brought some medical supplies out there, which we fundraised for, to a children's hospital, which wasn't getting supplies because Kiev was sort of surrounded, and normally the medical supplies come in by Kiev. So we did deliver those, and I thought the best thing I can do is train a bunch of trainers to share trauma knowledge. So I'm in contact with a local psychologist there, and they were like, look, we're overwhelmed as therapists, and it takes years to train the therapist, but just trauma, what's called trauma first aid and trauma education, go a long way and can be taught really quickly. And because I'd done that in the NGO world quite a lot, I was like, right, let's do that. Put a team together. I mean, it was a real miracle. Like, my best mate happens to be a Polish guy who drove me there. It was, you know, we were not sure if it was safe at first. We weren't sure how we'd get across the border. We had all these worries, and it was hardcore adventure, but we managed to pull off the training despite sort of near daily rocket attacks and having to do half the training in a bomb shelter. And that was the first training. Second one was a bit calmer. I came back a month or so later and did another one, a bit more organized this time. And now there's a whole team out there of over 100 trainers who are teaching thousands of school teachers, soldiers, children, you know, across the board. And how traumatized people are really depends what they've been through. So if I just said, like, the people we trained, so Ukrainians who live in Lviv have it's tense and they have some trauma, but it's not as much as people from Kiev usually, if depending on what region of Kiev they've been. If they've been, you know, I had a colleague who was one of my closest colleagues and friends there who was bombed pretty badly in Kiev. And then people coming from the east, it's normally even more so, or the south. You know, like, you see a bus of people coming from Mariupol or something, like, that's another level. And then in Poland, I worked there with refugees, and Poland feels a bit safer, it's a bit more pleasant, you know, working in Krakow with the refugee centers. And then Ukrainians in England, another thing. And then right through to my wife, who hasn't been there, but her parents are there. So she's got a lot of anxiety, and, you know, they became refugees and eventually moved back, actually, but they were refugees for a while. So it really depends on the people, but trauma affects people very deeply in different ways. And I see some of the difficult things, but I'm also extremely hopeful in that, you know, my team and other people doing this work will make Ukraine the most trauma-aware country in the world. And I've never seen a war where the military were deeply interested in trauma awareness from the start. Normally, Israel's a bit of an exception because they've got great psychologists and they've been pretty much at war continuously for 60 years. But mostly what happens is there's a war and everyone gets screwed up, and 10 years later, all the soldiers are getting divorces and they're alcoholic and they're in prison for violence. And then they sort of think about PTSD. Like, that's what happened with Vietnam, for example. This time, people are clued up and people are interested, and they regard it as progressive and Western to be interested in trauma. And it's the barriers are coming down. Like, you know, all the school teachers in Lviv, which is one of the biggest cities in the country, are going to be trauma trained by the end of the year. Now, I don't know of a city in the world like that. You know, I don't think London has that. I'm pretty sure it doesn't, in fact. I think it'll be the first city where, you know, every child is being educated by trauma-aware teachers. So while the war is horrific, in a way, like, that is a new chapter in what it means to be human, that trauma, which, you know, you can read about in the Iliad and the Bible and other things, you know, it's been around forever in different forms, is being really looked at. And, you know, a better world, the best world would be one with no war, but the next best world is there's a war, but there's trauma awareness.
Let's break down that word trauma, because, you know, it's a word that's as big as embodiment, I would say, in the last few years, especially in this
bigger.
Right. So there's trauma, the little T, there's trauma, the capital T, is what's one distinction of it. You know, there's, like, everyone in the coaching world is claiming or saying that they're now trauma informed. Like, you know, I'm not sure what that means. And we're not dealing with trauma that's necessarily the kind that you're experiencing directly in Ukraine. Right. So can you shed some light on this? Because you've been involved with Gabor Mate and some really, like, luminary Stephen voices. Ford,
yeah, all the people out there. Yeah. I mean, yeah. What the fuck is trauma is the first question, right? So when I first got involved in trauma was one of my Aikido mentors, Paul Linden, happened to work in abuse recovery. And this was, you know, I first met him, I don't know, 20 years ago. And at that time, 20 years ago, trauma was like this bizarre thing for maybe a few unfortunate kids needed, but that was, you know, it wasn't really talked about. And in the last 20 years, I've seen it become mainstream, which on the one hand is remarkably awesome. It's so cool that we get to talk about this, you know. People's mums know about trauma, but dads know about trauma. It's this, you know, thing that's fairly, you know, doctors sending me videos. A doctor friend sent me a video of Gabor Mate. Have you heard of this guy? I'm like, yeah, I've been hosting him online for years, you know. So it's awesome. You know, a film of Gabor Mate is very good that came through not long ago. So on the one hand, I think it's tremendously cool that trauma is becoming popular, but it's also become a bit sort of almost watered down. Right. And, you know, I think it's taken, the kind of hard left has taken a lot of trauma and run with it as a way to sort of seize power. You know, the word triggered used to mean something very definite in the trauma world. Now it just means I'm upset and I want to control you, right? It means you're a bad person and you're evil and have to do what I say, and I'm a victim, and therefore I'm, you know, I'm going to control from that position in the victim triangle. Fuck off, you know? And there's just some very, very damaged people in the activism world who have unaddressed trauma. That's another side issue. I've met a bunch of them, unfortunately. But so there's positives and negatives too. I mean, the basic, like, people say, yeah, but what is it, Mark? Any experience of overwhelm is like the broadest definition. And we all have those. So I tend to think of it as like, we all have some trauma, something that's called little T trauma. Some of us have more trauma than others. And I think on the one hand, it's subjective, but on the other hand, let's not compare someone getting upset that they spilt their ice cream with someone who's, you know, been abused as a kid, right? Let's not compare. And there is this great awareness of the sort of little chipping away kind of type of trauma rather than the necessary, like, one big event, like I had a car accident or something, right? I got mugged. Developmental trauma, you know, stuff growing up rather than necessarily shock trauma, like a big event. So there's these distinctions, big T, little T, shock, developmental, very useful. It's actually interesting. When I started the Ukraine project, I reached out to a lot of the big names in trauma. And some of them were like, we don't really deal with this. We just deal with, like, middle-class Californians who are upset. You know, I'm paraphrasing, but, you know, that was the message I got. And others were much more helpful. Stephen Porges is one of the good guys. He, you know, volunteered his time. He'd probably be embarrassed of me saying this, but his polyvagal theory is well worth a look. And, you know, there's some great teachers out there that are well-known. Organic intelligence is a system that's an offshoot of somatic experiencing, and the guy who founded that's been volunteering and helping with us. TRE people, David Baselli, is one of the few who's really worked in war zones. Most of them have just worked in clinical practice in California, and that's a very different environment if you've ever been to Northern California, even than central London, let alone Ukraine. So, you know, David Baselli and TRE is one of the good guys. That's the system we're informed by. Different things work for different people. But the problem is in the world today, people are selling a solution. So people have a modality which they're vested in selling, whereas the truth is trauma is holistic, meaning it has different aspects, and healing is holistic. And it's things like being in nature. We talk about eco-regulation in my group as well as co-regulation, that you can't really package and sell so easily, right? So yeah, there's all these weird agendas going on, all this complicatedness, but on the whole, I think it's cool that it's got big. And, you know, make no mistake, the trauma people are the biggest rock stars. Some of them won't get out of bed for less than 10 grand, you know, like some of them are pretty wealthy people making a lot of money, and some of them are just good hearted and they want to make the world a better place. And it is an industry now. Trauma is an industry. And of all the modalities like yoga and martial arts and qigong, you know, it's definitely the area of embodiment that draws the most people. Maybe it's passing a peak now, but certainly, you know, if I think, say, back at the embodiment conference 2 years ago, of the top five best attended talks, four of them were trauma teachers. And this is, you know, we had 10 different tracks, that trauma was one in 10, you know. So that's pretty interesting. But yeah, what is trauma? Being overwhelmed, and it's where we shut off from ourselves. I really think of it as two different things. One is being stuck in fight or flight, which I think intuitively makes sense to most people. And the other one is the numbing or the freeze response. And we use a really simple traffic light system for this in Ukraine, which literally even a child can understand. We have a SpongeBob SquarePants version of this, where we talk about green light, which is rest and digest, yellow light, which is activating, like play or like, you know, being alert, being at work, orange, which is fight or flight, which most people understand intuitively, which is a temporary thing, is not trauma. So if you get annoyed with your wife, you're not traumatized. Okay, but if you stay annoyed for the next 10 years, you are. And then the shutdown or the freeze response, which is the real overwhelming experience, not just unpleasant experience, you know. And, you know, that you might get from shelling. You know, you can get it directly, but you can also get it vicariously. You know, I shed a lot of tears after these Ukraine trips, and it wasn't so much what I saw, it was just even what people told me, that was pretty harsh at times. It was just being around the bodies. And I can tell when any of I supervise my team online. It's not really my team anyway, actually. I shouldn't say that. It's Jenya's and Katharina's team. You know, it's two local women who took over it and registered it as a charity locally and run it. Awesome women. And I can tell when one of their team is not in Ukraine, because they take holidays. They go to Turkey, or one of them's in Canada recently. There's a lot of Ukrainians. So they go across the border to Poland to visit their mom, and they look different. You know, their face change, the relaxation comes in the face, the co-regulatory kind of responsiveness comes back, and the eyes change, the tension patterns change, and they feel different to be around. You know, I was dancing in the woods in Portugal recently after coming back from Ukraine, and it was rough, you know, because it was the opposite. It was great to let go of being in a war zone, being in the woods surrounded by hippies with nice teachers. I knew the place, I knew the owners, I knew the teachers, nice people there, it was friendly, and it was like just layers of shit just dropping off me. I didn't even realize were there.
Are you, what's the long-term kind of scenario or plan? What's driving you? You know, like, what are you going to be doing now? Are you heading back there? You're in Brighton. What's the plan?
Well, my plan's always been to help in some small way to create a more embodied world, whether that be through books, podcasts, we do a lot of online courses, we do, you know, projects like Ukraine Project, whatever that's through. I mean, I'm going to be supervising and going back there fairly regularly. My job is just kind of supervising online and then helping with the actual trainings run by Kate and Jenya there. Yeah, so that project continues, and we will continue it until Ukraine is victorious and the Russian invaders have been thrown out. If it's not obvious, I've chosen a side here. You know, it's very clear. It doesn't mean I hate all Russians. I still have Russian students, for example, but, you know, I've stopped all business in Russia. I don't go there anymore. And, you know, we will continue that project for as long as it's necessary, which is probably going to be the next 10 years. And, you know, I'll always contribute to that in some way. And yeah, as I said, in my day job really is training coaches and trainers and occasionally yoga teachers or therapists. And, like today, my day was running a business and doing some mentoring, doing some supervision of coaches, teaching a little group of mentees that I have. You know, that's the main thing I do. But I think there'll always be different ways to teach embodiment, and Yeah, like it's nice doing face-to-face trainings again, you know, after all the Zoom. Zoom's great for spreading out learning. It's great for reaching more people, being accessible, which is a good thing, you know. Though we just did a workshop in Slovenia by Lake Bled, which is a gorgeous location. And it was just like, oh, this is nice, you know. Like, it's nice to do live events, even if they don't make anybody. So, yeah, I guess I'll just keep doing that. I don't really want to do some of the sort of large scale stuff so much, you know, like we did the conference and it was huge. And I sort of accidentally became in charge of an online learning company afterwards. I ended up being just a manager and being like a manager of a tech company. I sort of reassessed that. I've got to run back to teaching, really, which is more what I love. And we'll always do books and podcasts and things like that. But I think it's one to watch out for if you go big. And there's a lot of unwanted attention that comes with that and unpleasantness. And sometimes it's nice. Like, I got recognized in the vegetarian restaurant on Saturday in Brighton by a couple of people. It was pleasant. You know, they just wanted to say thank you. But other times it's a bit much. I certainly wouldn't recommend chasing money to too much. I don't think that creates life purpose or chasing fame or money or acclaim. From the little taste I've had of those things, I recommend not making that your focus in life if you're a young guy listening to this.
Yeah, that's sound advice. And if you'd have told my 26-year-old that, then yeah, it would have been helpful. In terms of like men and women, I'm curious about this angle. Like, when you work with embodiment and you're teaching these practices, do you see any kind of differences in the way that they show up or behave? Are they some more open than others? Is it helpful to kind of separate men and women and to teach certain practices? Do you see that there's a difference there? Because you acknowledged earlier that men and women are different, and I'm with you there. But is it helpful to sort of separate them off, to kind of separate the inevitable sort of sexual tension that can be there? Perhaps not in a trauma course, but, you know, that. Is it worth separating them? Do you see that there's a difference there, or yes. Is this just old hat?
Yes, absolutely. It's worth doing some of the time. Like, some of the worst adjusted people I know grew up in boys' schools or girls' school. Some of the best adjusted people I know went to Scouts or Brownies or whatever it was and had some time with men or boys, or girls or women. I think that's profoundly helpful. I think every tribal society in human history has done that, as far as I've seen anthropologically. Not all the time, but at least some of the time. I think it's profoundly healthy to do. And sometimes we'll just do a lunch where it'll be like a lunch for the guys and I'll take them off on a course, you know? And the conversation changes and the feeling changes. And largely, I think men and women are better around each other. You know, we co-supervise, I think. We balance each other out somehow. It'd be a surprise if evolution had created a species that had, you know, people would argue, but more or less two basic flavors, and that they didn't balance each other out. That would be strange. We're complementary. And I think whether you're gay or straight or whatever, you know, I know a lot of gay guys in Brighton. They have a lot of female friends. It's complementary. You know, there's something in there. So I think there is benefit to it. I don't think we should have necessarily radically different practices. You know, I've done Aikido with lots of women, and I'm quite comfortable doing martial arts with women. And, you know, I've been in spaces where that friction could be very interesting and helpful if it's managed well. You know, I was saying, let's not deny that exists between people. Like, the average office has to sort of completely neuter itself and pretend it doesn't exist these days. And it does exist. Yeah, that's my views, and I'm not a gender expert, but I know what I see, and I know from doing embodiment work that it can be helpful at times.
Thank you. I wanted to hear your perspective on that. Just adding to my own thought process of kind of where we're going. I'm aware of the time that we've got to sort of start to draw things to a close. But I mean, when you heard
the man, a bit more if it flows. So I'm enjoying this. So if you're good.
No, I am. I mean, I'm curious about when you saw that there was a Man Reimagined podcast, like, what kind of came to mind for you and what inspired you to come talk to me in the Man Reimagined podcast, as opposed to kind of, you know, Jeff's podcast about Jeff?
Yeah. Well, I think there's definitely interesting things going on with masculinity. I think it does need, in a way, standing up for, because I think it's so easy and so cheap and so common to just attack men and masculinity now. And it's not okay. It's not okay anymore. And it's okay to say sexist things about women. You know, it's not okay. And I think it's at the root of some of the pathologies in our culture. And I think intelligent, thoughtful people of all sexes need to be discussing it. So that's one thing. Secondly, just personally, I'd love more male students. You know, I like on my last course in Slovenia, I think there was 3 guys and 27 women. And that I'm pretty male friendly as an embodiment teacher. Blokes feel pretty comfortable around me and in my classes, and I'm not making anyone wrong for having a cock, you know? So it's, you know, I'm feeling like if I'm not getting many men, I don't know if anyone is. And even in some countries, it's better than others, for sure, some places and some locations. But I've seen a falling away of men in embodiment workshops the last few years. First online, I thought it was a function of Zoom, but now in person. And I'm really curious about that. And I'd love to see more men in the embodiment world and have more male students personally as well. So this is, you know, I see a male podcast. I think, yeah, jump on. Maybe a few people will turn up to things. And I see the embodiment world has this kind of hardcore feminist and not in a good way agenda often increasingly these days. And sometimes in a sort of fun feminine way. Like I see a lot of sort of like, you know, femininity, female empowerment work around wombs and periods and conscious sexuality for women coming out of Bali and stuff, and it just looks cool, and I kind of went, good for the women, you know. But I'd love to see a bit more embodied men's work and that coming in. So I think it is happening. I think, you know, men are increasingly men are drawn to embodied practices, I think, and they see that. I just want to move that along a little bit.
Beautiful. I mean, I had to chuckle when you mentioned the Bali thing, having lived there for some time and seen that. And you mentioned kind of the softer kind of men that are attracted to the more feminized work in this area. And yet I'm interested to hear you say that there were more men in the past and that it's dropped off lately. Like, that's a surprise. I always thought it was always low. So, I mean, tell me about when there were more men and what kind of men were showing up and what was the deal?
Right, well, it really depends on the practice. And there was always less men, but I might get 40% men in a workshop, for example. And I was told that was above average. I was told the average was 20 to 30%, say Britain or the United States. Although it depends on, like, if you get more athletic practices, you might see, you know, obviously you're doing some martial arts, it might be 90% men. But generally, I think there has been some sort of drop off across the board, though there's been a drop off. I thought it's like men don't like Zoom as much. They prefer in person. I think there is an environment where you can get in more trouble and you can be made bad and wrong. And why would you turn up somewhere where you can't speak because that's mansplaining and you can't take up space because that's manspreading? And if you flirt with a woman, you're now a sexual predator. Like, why would they do that? Why would they not just stay at home? Like, that's not an environment that's supportive. You know, I was in a dance school in London, in Elephant and Castle, a well-known one called, I'm going to name it, the Siobhan Davies Dance School. And there was a woman in there who had a T-shirt that said, "Replace all men with machines." It was dance. That was her T-shirt. And it was a dance class with 50 women, one gay guy, one old guy, and me. And I said, I've already done a lot to walk across the threshold here,
right?
You know, I've already done a lot culturally to be in a modern dance class in London. This is a big deal. And I challenged the young lady. I said, this, you know, I don't feel very welcome when I see that T-shirt, you know. Now I talked to her, turns out cool lady, actually. She worked in tech, and in her environment in the tech sector, that T-shirt's funny because it's dominated by men. And that's a very different environment. But this is why people don't understand things like privilege or whatever are situational. Because in that situation, I was the minority. And she clocked it. And to her credit, we had a pretty good conversation about it. But I was actually temporarily banned from that dance school because when I challenged her on this, I did so in front of the class and several women got upset and went out crying. I didn't raise my voice. I didn't swear. It's very reasonable. It was very centered in how I did it. And, you know, it was investigated by the hardcore feminist management. And, you know, they eventually, you know, realized I'd done absolutely nothing wrong, of course. And I was said, when they said, you can come back if you want. And I was like, I'm never coming back. There's no way. This is not a male friendly environment. You know, and that's the brochure just had all women on it as well. You know, it's like, you want more men in your yoga studio. Well, have you got any pictures of men up on the wall or on your website? Simple things like that sometimes. So, but no one thinks this way. And I get it because we're not used to thinking this way, right? We're used to thinking of of indifferent, you know, the other way around. And that is definitely the case. Like, you know, running a martial arts club, how do you make it more female friendly and make it as a place where women feel welcome and safe? And that's really important too. So I don't want to like play my violin too loudly here. But that was just, and that's, I'm just picking that as one example, whereas a guy, I just went, I'm never going back there. That was a nightmare, you know? And there's been other places where it's been not been okay to be a bloke. So yeah, I think these things do need to be challenged, and I personally will. But yeah, that's the journey I've seen over the years. And in terms of the guys who traditionally went to embodiment, sometimes they were just very feminine men, either typologically or because they were going through a developmental stage, or because they lived in Bali and smoked too much weed and grew their hair long. And, you know, they sort of, their embodiment shifted to being, we might say, more yin, to use a less loaded word, a more yin embodiment. And those guys normally go for a progression where people do that for a while. And then at a certain point, they want to get their oomph back. They want to get the fire in their belly back. And that's a, when they go to that stage, they might change their practices, for example, away from certain types of yoga or certain types of conscious dance. So there is a sequence or a progression that people can go through in embodiment. And it's sometimes necessary for guys to really embrace that, like feeling flowing kind of side of themselves.
Yeah, I mean, you just described my experience in Bali. You know, I sort of dived into the ecstatic dance and whatnot. Like, and now I've kind of, to come full circle, it's really clear to me, like, that's not my jam. And it's not like I'm not comfortable with it. It's like, I've tried it, but it's like, this is where I'm good. I'm getting into jujitsu and like Qigong. And it's like, this is my thing, you know? And so like, it does seem like a healthy sort of progression to be able to sort of dive into that and then kind of find out where you are. And of course, some people want to stay over there, and there's no right or wrong about it, right? It's just like,
no, and it's great. I love those environments. You know, I was in Bali, and like, it was super like soft, easy, relaxed place. And I was there for a week on holiday, and I loved it. You know, I was in Ubud and doing the yoga classes, and I was like, this is great. I wouldn't want to live it. You know, it's funny, my wife is Ukrainian. She said, the problem with these people is they think life is easy. And I was like, yeah, it is. Do you want a mango? You know, so it's like, you know, environments are really powerful, and I've been in a few of them, but it's great. It's great to embody, to take on different environments. You know, like Brighton's quite a soft environment compared to London. It's interesting to do that. And we need different practices at different times. You know, I've been really enjoying weightlifting at the moment, but I would have really looked down upon that years ago. You know, I did 10 years of Aikido, 15 years of solo Aikido. Now I don't do so much. You know, I still dance, conscious dance regularly, but that's changed what that is for me over the years. And listen, I think we're rambling a bit now, but different things for different people at different times. And my basic philosophy with any embodiment practice is all good. Do what you love. You know, any guys listening to this, don't feel like you have to do martial arts or competitive martial arts like jiu-jitsu, you know, which is great. You don't have to do it though. You don't have to weightlift. You can do whatever floats your boat. And I always say, just if you're newer to embodiment, just find something you enjoy, something that's convenient, get to it, enjoy it. It will improve your life. It will change your life. And I don't know anyone that's taken up an embodied practice and regretted it, you know? So, you know, whether you want to take up partner dance to get closer to your wife, or some sort of play improv practice to have fun with your kids, or martial arts to reclaim some of that strength that society says we shouldn't have now. Like, there's so much out there, and it's just a feast. So I just encourage anyone listening to fill your boots.
That feels like a kind of a nice place to wrap things up, right? Like, fill your boots with embodiment, find your own kind of practice that seems accessible and actually like just fun, right? That's kind of the message that I'm hearing you say. Is that a nice way to sum it up?
Yeah, enjoy it. Like, if people are professionals, they might want to be careful they're not just deepening their neuroticism and getting one-sided, and you know, I coach a lot of people on that. But if people are sort of newer to this, I just find something that's appeal, give it a go, do what you can do with your kids or your wife, whatever makes it convenient and happy. And embodied world's a better world, you know. An embodied world is a less traumatized world, it's a more peaceful world, it's a world with better leaders. You know, we look at the drug problems, we look at the stress and the anxiety issues. Like, embodiment isn't a cure-all. There's lots of things the world needs, right? But it sure helps. It sure helps. So, yeah, you know, I'm finishing my Monday day. Just gone 7 p.m. I've been working since 8 a.m. I'm energized. I'm happy to be doing what I'm doing, you know? So I'd love that for everyone, whether they be in an extreme situation like in Ukraine and needing you know, trauma support, or whether they're just a stressed office worker in East London who's, you know, working on a computer all day and starting to get a sore neck and a stressed out mind.
Ah, beautiful. Mark, after listening to this again, there was so much in there, and I'm sure listeners will be in the same space as well. Thank you for your time. Thank you for your energy as well. It's like an expansion on what embodiment means and so much more. So is there anything that you want to kind of shamelessly plug, or kind of not necessarily your own work, but perhaps somebody else?
Well, if we get cancelled, Rich, I will see you in cancellation Valhalla. And it'll be fine. Don't worry about it. People are far too scared of other people's opinions. They can't fucking do anything. Don't apologize and don't back down. So embodimentunlimited.com, loads of free resources there on trauma, on coaching, on yoga, anything you're interested, loads of free shit there. The book, if you read the books, podcast, if you listen to the podcast. And if you don't like me, there's loads of other great embodiment teachers out there. Just look around, you'll find a whole bunch. There's some really good ones in the world. You know, so many practices, so many teachers. So, you know, it's not just me, there's loads. So yeah. Hope that gives people a few pointers.
Well, and of course, all of these links will be in the show notes for people to go check out, and I urge them to do so. Mark, pleasure, sir. Thank you so much for your time.
Richard, pleasure. I'm going to go eat my dinner, but it's nice talking to you. Take care.
Likewise. Ciao.
From this week's podcast, if there's been anything that's inspired you, challenged you, or simply left you wanting more, then please reach out to Richie and Mal via their Facebook page, Man Reimagined. Just like you, we're trying to get a handle on all these issues and topics, so the more we're able to share and talk about them, I think the better off we're all going to be. Until next time, catch you later.